Thank you very much, Jim. That was excellent paper. It's not my job to comment on it, but that was certainly interesting and provocative. We're fortunate to have three very able people to comment on the paper today. We're going to run about 10 minutes apiece, I think, somewhere in that neighborhood. The first commenter is Robert L. Schuettinger, an old friend of mine. He's a senior research associate of the Republican Study Committee in the House of Representatives, has a distinguished academic career, having taught at Catholic University, Yale, St. Andrews University in Scotland, teaching in political science. Has published and author of The Conservative Tradition in European Thought, Lord Acton, Historian of Liberty, A History of Price and Wage Controls, and other books and articles. He is a book review editor of the Journal of Science and Political Affairs. Bob?
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, and friends, my good and old friend Jim McClellan has given us a very, very factual and very, very insightful paper on what has happened to Congress in the last 40 years. He, of course, has combined his many years as a teacher and student of American politics with several years of practical experience in Washington since 73. As an old teacher myself, I might just add that I think it's one's liberal education, which one gets in college and perhaps in graduate school, and such things as political philosophy and so on, which enables you to take advantage of experience. I think he has hit the nail on the head in that one of the greatest problems with Congress is the tremendous proliferation of the power of unelected staff, speaking as one myself. We have now, as you mentioned, a total staff of something like 35,000 people. This is larger than the largest city in Vermont, for instance, Burlington, where I come from. We have our own weekly newspaper, Roll Call, and every week there's a story in it, some happy event, someone being paroled, and perhaps an unhappy event, someone being fined or indicted or awaiting trial or appealing or, worse yet, actually serving time. This is true, by the way. I might give just one or two examples from my own experience of the negative power of congressional staff. The Washington Monthly in May of 1974 had a very important article about a group of only 20 ex-Foreign Service officers. These are young and very well-educated men in their late 30s and 40s who left the State Department because they found they could not influence a policy in the direction they wanted. And they moved to the key slots in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, of course, and on the staff, so people like Senator Church, Senator Case, Senator Javits. And by working together over the past several years in a kind of informal mafia, they have managed to turn around American foreign policy. The War Powers Act was largely done by them, and it's all laid out in this article. And yet no one has ever heard of these people. I never heard of them until I read the article, in fact. They're not in the newspapers or magazines. They are there behind the scenes, though. Jim has referred to the Budget Committee staff, which is notoriously large, almost 200, Cadillac and all. They will be increasing their power in the future because there's a nice little kicker to that setup, whereby the members of Congress, senators and representatives, who serve on the Budget Committee, they have a set term of 4 years. This is unusual. It's unique, in fact, in Congress. Whereas the staff, you see, goes on forever. And, of course, knowing how busy members are, one can easily see that it takes them 2 or 3 years to learn the ropes, and by the time they begin to get a handle on the staff, they are going, you see. It's a perfect setup. And so I would like to advocate that one of the things we might do is to reduce the numbers of congressional staff. And this is not entirely unfeasible because there's a very high turnover among this group anyway. And they could be the jobs could simply not be filled when somebody retires or moves on. So it's not unfeasible. Now, of course, there are problems with this. I took a little empirical political science survey in the bar last night. I asked several friends what they thought was the ratio between conservative and liberal staff on the Hill. And this was done without a $50,000 NSF grant. And it's probably just about as accurate, I think. I got various estimates, anywhere from 6 liberals to 1 conservative to 10 liberals to 1 conservative, with the proviso that there is a certain number who have no particular values whatever and will just do as they're told. These people, of course, practically must be counted as liberals, as Franklin Roosevelt was well aware. You know, he said that he always counted the undecideds for himself, and he's quite right. So if you say that there are roughly 6 or maybe as many as 10 liberals for every conservative staff man, then you see where our policy should lie. Now, people like Bill Schneider, Jim, Ed Fulner, and I will be victims of this purge, of course. But how often in a military situation do you get the opportunity to take 6 to 10 of them with you? Not very often. Unless you're Japanese. I'd like to give you just two good examples of my personal observation of how this system works. One of my very ableist colleagues, David Swope, a man who was very largely responsible for the California Welfare Reform Plan, which reduced the welfare rolls, while at the same time providing better benefits for those who were truly needy, has been the principal drafter of the Buckley-Michael Food Stamp Reform Bill, which most of you have probably been following. Now, in his work, he recently went through the Federal Register and discovered out of the blue that the poverty, official government poverty line, had been changed from roughly $5,000 a year income before taxes to $5,000 a year income after taxes. This, of course, makes a tremendous difference, you see. Difference of hundreds of millions of dollars in food stamps and so on. He tried to track down who determined, who made this decision, you see. And he tried the Secretary of Agriculture. He tried the Secretary of HEW. He tried various congressmen, of course. He tried the White House. No one knew. He tried the Census Bureau, Bureau of Labor Statistics, etc. Finally, after much work, he found his man. It was a, quote, senior economist in the Agriculture Department, a GS-9 who had just gotten an MA in economics. And this young man was very proud of what he had done and was quite eager to talk about it. And David said, well, I see you're called senior economist. Is that an official department title? He said, well, not really. It's just I've been here 6 months, and the guy at the next desk has been here 3 months, so I call myself senior economist. And this a worthy young man, from very good motives, no doubt, made a government decision, which, as I said, affects hundreds of millions, perhaps $1 billion, who knows. And Congress had nothing whatever to do with this. Another example of the negative and obstructive power of staff, this time the White House staff, took place with David also. For literally a year, he had been trying to get in to see President Ford with some other top aides and members of Congress. And every time, he was turned back by the ring that guards the Oval Office. But one day, the system broke down. No system is perfect, you see. And lo and behold, there he was. He found himself in the office. And he presented to President Ford, on one sheet of paper, of course, the Buckley-Michael Bill, you say, neatly summarized according to 10 main points. And Ford read this in a few minutes, of course, and he said, well, this sounds very good. I'm for this. And David said, great, can we take that down? He said, yes, certainly, I will back this all the way. And, of course, his staff got to him before the day was out, and he had to back down a bit. But still, his interest was aroused, and as you know, the president has now implemented a number of executive order changes which will ameliorate the program somewhat. But again, a good example of the tremendous power of the staff to keep things from elected people. So I would suggest, as one direction in which we should move, is to reduce these people in number. Another recommendation which I would like to suggest, David Broder, who's probably one of the most astute and ablest political commentators in Washington, had a very important article in the Washington Post a few months ago. And there he suggested that in order to have effective government, we must have a unity between the president and Congress. That is to say, we must elect a president and a Congress who will work together. Now, of course, the only way that can be done is by electing a liberal Democratic president and a liberal Democratic Congress, because you're not going to get a conservative president, and not a really conservative president, and you're certainly not going to get a conservative Congress in the near future. So his implication was quite clear. There was only one way to do that. But I would like to suggest another way, and that is for Congress, if they wish to be effective, not to make more laws, but to repeal laws, because they can make their influence felt by the act of repealing laws. This may sound, in the first instance, as being negative, but if you think about it, it is positive in the long run. Because if you accept the basic principle that Congress makes broad laws, which then are interpreted by that vast army of GS-12s, with their 60,000-page Federal Register every year, where these regulations are announced, whom no one elected to office has even bothered to read, let alone approve, then you see the merit of acting in this manner. For instance, the post office monopoly on first-class mail could be repealed. That would have a real effect. Then hundreds of private arrangements would spring up in its place, you see. And Congress could really be doing something constructive for the country, and its will, in that instance, would not be frustrated by this army of bureaucrats. So by repealing laws, I would say, is one of the best ways Congress can be effective. I would just like, in a few minutes remaining, to throw out three or four more very brief suggestions, and perhaps some of you will have ways of improving on these ideas. William Niskanen, a very, very able economist, has written a very important book called Democracy and Representative Government, in which he applies the principles of economics to politics. And he notes, just very briefly, that there is only one, or at least one major area of legislation in which the national interest is paramount, and that is national defense, and of course foreign policy, in which we all benefit or lose from what the policy is. Most other bills involve some special interest. They involve certain favors for one section of the country. They benefit, and the rest of us, of course, do not. Or indeed, we may suffer. Therefore, Niskanen proposes a two-thirds rule, whereby it would take two-thirds of Congress to pass a bill which involved special interest legislation. The theory behind this, of course, is that if you get two-thirds for it, it will represent the good of at least a very broad part of the country and at least eliminate the special interest provisions to some extent.
Bob, excuse me, yeah.
Oh, yeah, right. Well, this, of course, is difficult to do, but it's worth considering. And just briefly, I'd just like to add one more practical possibility. We now have environmental impact statements attached to every bill, where you must show how your bill will affect the environment. And we managed last year to get an inflation impact statement attached. You have to show how your bill, whatever it is, will affect inflation. This, of course, is good. We might have an interest group impact statement. How will this bill, you see, affect a particular interest group? In other words, make them put it out on a table so that so-and-so will benefit primarily, and we know exactly where we stand. If we did this, I think, we might be moving in the right direction. So I think these are some ideas that we might perhaps consider. Thank you.